We're with Dr. Walter Jacob. The hour we lost is taking us longer because Rabbi Jacob is elaborating more, and we're delighted. And this is now, again, Mary Harrison is the interviewer, and Gabby Dinman is taking notes, which is always nice. Tape 6, side 11. Walter, you were talking about bar mitzvahs and the fact that the long service might chase away some of the people, so they were shorter, and
some
of the children were not reading as well.
No, it's the nature. The issue is whether the child reads the entire service and dominates the service, or whether the child does what is traditionally done, which is the Torah service. I decided right off that we would opt for the latter, so that we would not lose our normal Saturday morning attendance, which is what happens in congregations, where the child dominates. It becomes a private service, not only because the family sends out invitations and it ends up being more or less by invitation, but because children at age 13 are not capable of leading a service in most instances. The other thing, so we were able, because it was late, to set this up in such a way that it worked, it fitted in, and and I also saw to it that I made it as a matter of policy of not attending any of the social affairs afterwards for two reasons. One is that often I or whoever was with me as an assistant or associate were busy with lots of other things, and it would be difficult to find time, or can't really say to a youth group, we're not going to come to you because we have to go to a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah lunch. And the other was as a clear indication that it was the religious part that interested me, not the social function. And so
you mentioned there were 66 bar mitzvahs?
No, in 1966 we began bar mitzvahs. Mm-hmm. The number of bar and bat mitzvahs has varied every year, and usually they are not every week, but heavy in spring and fall, lighter at times when it's difficult for relatives who live in Florida to come north.
Everybody is bar mitzvah, or do they? It's
purely
elective.
Optional.
It's optional, and also girls proportionally to boys.
Yes, the number has always been about the same, and almost everybody continues on to confirmation, and that's been important. That did not, and whatever reason, I don't know why Dr. Freehoff was so opposed at the end of his life. Partly it probably was to shield confirmation, but of course the ironic part was that he celebrated the anniversary of his bar mitzvah every year.
Gabby also asked you about other changes that you made.
Okay,
about adult education.
Okay, one ought to go at that perhaps a little more systematically than we did then.
Okay.
Because what needed to be done, and what needs to be done every once in a while, is a thorough look at the whole life of the congregation. So one of the first things was to look at the service pattern. We decided with the worship committee that Friday night the 5:30 service would stay, Saturday morning would be emphasized more, and Sunday morning the service from November through April, which had always been a weekday service, had never been a substitute for Shabbat, would also stay. That service, I believe, was probably started by J. Leonard Levy at the turn of the century, largely for people who couldn't make it on Shabbat, remained quite popular and had the advantage of providing an opportunity to give a serious talk at a time when people were awake.
It was really like a lecture.
Yes. A short service, Because if you try to do that on Friday night at 8:30, it's tough. We decided also to stay with the family service on Sunday morning once a month, and to experiment with Friday evening services, late Friday evening. And efforts were made both as a family service once a month, as a junior congregation service. A variety of formats were tried in the succeeding years. None of them really worked. So then we decided to simply stay with the service format as it was. In the last years, that's jumping way ahead, we have moved in the direction of more specialized services, as we have again gone to 3 and now 4 rabbis. So a tot service, a service for families, young families, every other Friday evening. For a while we had a single service. We've tried a library service, an intimate service on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, youth service. So this is in the last, and the daily service in the last 2 years. What we also worked on ages ago was an effort to try to get families to do other things during holidays, and to build sukkahs, and put more emphasis also on the evenings of the holidays. So a real Simchas Torah, not just the consecration on the first day of Sukkot, a Purim service on the eve of Purim, not simply on the Sunday closest to it. So that pattern changed, and eventually also we adopted the but that's much later than 66, the new prayer book. That was about a decade later.
And why was that? What prompted the change in prayer book?
Well, it took them a long time to develop a new prayer book, with a different in language and a difference in orientation. We were a little slower in adopting it because Dr. Freehoff had been the principal editor of the previous prayer book, so we didn't want to hurt his feelings. But simply the language had changed enough that it became useful to do that, although as far as poetry goes, the gates of prayer is vastly inferior to the Union Prayer Book, which is much more poetic. And there were also humorous matters connected with that, because when we adopted it, we of course got copies for the committee, the worship committee, and they looked at it, and talked about it, debated it. Lester Aaron was very much for keeping the other prayer book, and presented a very learned defense of the prayer book, but the committee eventually decided, along with me, that we would go in the other direction. What was funny was, a few years later, we did the same thing with the High Holiday prayer book. They all took the book home, supposedly read it. We had a couple of sessions for them on it. My guess is that 90% didn't go much beyond the cover. And when we adopted it and decided to use it, we were most unhappy.
Almost because they were traditionalists, or just
no, because there were changes, and they hadn't really. Although we talked about the changes, they didn't realize the impact that the changes would have on them and on the rest of the congregation. And so we decided at that point for the holidays to use both prayer books. And we use one in the evening and the other in the morning. Keep everybody either at the same degree of happiness or unhappiness. That has worked. We will slowly phase that, the older prayer book out. In the interim, before we adopted the new High Holiday prayer book, we had paper back editions, pamphlets, which added to it. We also experimented with various kinds of experimental services in the 60s, when that was the rage, you might say, did what we could.
You also changed Haggadahs, didn't you? There were Haggadahs.
Yes, the we changed Haggadahs. The old Haggadah, which is again, in this case, a beautiful format. The language is not all that good. It leaves out a lot of things. So that change, for me at least, was very easy. And at home, I prefer to use the traditional Haggadah. The new Union Haggadah, interestingly enough, it's probably the only time we've done that, is longer than the traditional Haggadah. And if you really read it all the way through, you're guaranteed to be there almost till midnight. We also changed a lot of music in the service. That's one of the things I wanted to do, bring in a lot more traditional music. Try to get the congregation to sing, which is almost impossible.
But an opera star like Mimi Lerner, do you think she generated a...
Well, she helped because she has a way of trying to get people involved. But people are just reluctant. And then when they have sung a melody for a few years, and you decide they ought to be sufficiently bored with it to try another one, then people will come up to you and say, as they've come up to me, look, we have sung this Mircho Mocho for generations. We can't change it. And the truth of the matter is, 10 years ago, they didn't sing it at all. So those kinds of things, more participation, slowly over the years, of kids in the service, in the last decade, bringing the kids up for Kiddush at each service, celebrating the children's birthdays at the service, adults, more participation in the Torah service, sometimes having adults read the Torah, having people blow the shofar, having whole classes learn how to blow the shofar, ordering 30, 40 shofars each year for that purpose. So these kinds of changes in the ritual of the congregation. And when they were imaginative assistants like Rabbi Pomerantz, having very radical services, multimedia services, jazz services, and so on, which take an enormous amount of work.
And how long have you been doing the naming, the baby naming?
Oh, babe, I can't date these things, but my guess is certainly 20 to 25 years. And asking couples to come up for blessings when they're about to be married, or at least making that an option. So this sort of thing. And the main matter which is at issue is making changes at a pace that you're not going to lose the older members of the congregation, or that they do not feel, because we didn't have as much Hebrew, our prayers were not as genuine, because they certainly were. And other changes too, sometimes which are difficult, but if you make them, you just... I decided that those changes which were of a more emotional character, not liturgical, would just be made at the appropriate point.
Such as,
should the Israeli flag be on the pulpit? Well, how do you do that? It stirs a great debate. So, fortunately, there was a war, and we had a service at the temple, a community-wide service to support Israel. And of course, the Israeli flag was put on the pulpit. And this was in 67, I think. So after that happened, I simply instructed the custodian not to remove it.
Have you had objections?
There were objections. And then somebody said, well, it looks to me like it's a little higher than the American flag. So we cut an inch off the, 2 inches off the pole, but it stayed up there. And the same thing occurred later on with much later on, that was only about 6-7 years ago, with a tallit. The rabbis had never worn any robes. And there were many suggestions that I wear a robe, and I simply brush them aside, because I don't think that anything that makes the rabbi more distant from the congregation is to my mind wrong. But what about a tallit? Well, I decided one summer, we were going to do this. It happened to be a summer when we were celebrating, it was 92. We were celebrating Columbus and the Sephardic tradition. So in the middle of summer, it happened to be at that service, we put on a tallit. Nobody said anything. All the rabbis put on a tallit, because they thought this is to illustrate the Sephardic tradition. But the next week, we also had a tallit on. And after that, too, the worship committee was, the chair of the worship committee was very unhappy. He said he should have been consulted. I guess he should have been consulted. But this is the kind of thing that leads to a big debate. And we consulted him in retrospect. And that there wasn't, of course, once he had started this and people had gotten accustomed to it, he didn't realize that this was happening for maybe 8 or 10 weeks afterward. It was too late.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
What is the tradition of the tallit? And the reason I ask it is I noticed some women were.
Yes.
Sure.
The tradition is that it's worn by males, and it is, there are two traditions, you might say. One is that a small tallit, which is really worn under your shirt, is worn all the time. Probably the tallit originally was a general Jewish garb, as every nationality had its garb. Eventually, it became a garb worn only during services during daylight hours. So you'll notice we never wear a tallit on Friday evening. In many congregations, they do, because that's the main service. We've simply stuck with the other tradition. Of course, we feel that men and women are completely equal, so a woman would wear a tallit too. And that also meant that in the years, I slowly moved people to not wearing a tallit, but at least if somebody did wear a tallit in the congregation, not to be unhappy about it, or if they wore a kippah. And nowadays, a fair number of people do. But that's, of course, also a reflection of what has happened in the society around us, that people are much more willing to show themselves as Jews than they were before, and to sort of do this publicly. So some of my colleagues wear a kippah, some don't. I wear a kippah sometimes, not in this congregation. And sometimes not in a congregation where, let's say an American congregation, where they are opting for uniformity. I want to show them you're just as good as you if you don't wear one. But in a European setting, I'll wear a kippah, of course.
But not out on the street as the Orthodox do.
No. And so that takes us for as far as services go. Let's talk about education. First of all, children's education. The entire religious school was looked over by the professor of education of the Hebrew Union College. We had a committee, we had a format, we had questionnaires, and a great many meetings. and changes were made. And all of this, of course, was done with Stanley Levin, who was an excellent principal and a highly imaginative individual, who also went to great trouble to try to see to it that in our large religious school, everybody in each grade level knew everybody else, which meant going through all the cards, let's say for grade 8, and shuffling the kids around so that they would not be just with their friends, but with other kids too. Did his best to work with the parents and children, and had a real rapport with both children and parents.
He was part of the Pittsburgh Public School System, wasn't he?
Is this where I talked about him? Or?
No.
Okay. He was director of music in the Pittsburgh Public School. So there were changes in the religious school, and we created at that point a viable high school program, which has continued on. And also, I think already earlier, had created a program of special education, which only slowly phased out in the last couple of years because we haven't had anybody with problems of retardation or serious psychological problems. Adult education, I was interested in greatly expanding, so both Hebrew classes and more serious classes of other kinds, which dealt with all kinds of subjects and ran for at least 8-10 weeks, sometimes longer, sometimes a whole year. They again have expanded as we've had people to do it. You know, with two rabbis, there are some limits, and for a long time there was hardly anybody you could call on in the community to do some serious teaching. You know, Nick Lane would teach a course every once in a while. Somebody else would give some lectures. Your son would give some lectures on the Jews of Syria and the like. But it was tough to find somebody to give an organized course. But that expanded, and people were interested, and the various arms of the congregation were quite willing to participate in that too. And then bringing in guest lecturers, Jewish guest lecturers, on a regular basis on Sunday mornings, sometimes for a weekend, having retreats out in the country, taking not just the kids but adults.
Was this part of the Sunday morning breakfast group? Or?
No, this was separate from that. So you'd have a whole weekend devoted to a subject, and Sunday morning and Sunday afternoon, or take people out. But again, the problem was if you did that, one of us had to go. When there were only two of us, that sort of limited the number of times you could do that. So then the third area of expansion was social action. Again, because of limitations just two of us as rabbis, it depended very much on the chair of the Social Action Committee, what really would happen. And for a long time, we took a very active role in civil rights working with poor people generally. After a while, we ended up doing more of this through financial support or occasional support with people. The Race and Religion Council of Pittsburgh still meets here on a monthly basis. I've been involved in that for 40 years or so. Project Equality, using Afro-American suppliers, looking at Afro-Americans for possible positions.
You have a gay group that meets here?
That's, yes, but that's not something that was even raised 30 years ago. That's in the last 5-6 years. We've always been hospitable to other groups here, Jewish and non-Jewish. So the Tree of Life met here, when their new building was going up for 2 years in the Levy Hall. Currently, we host the Reconstructionist congregation in the Levy Hall or in the chapel on Shabbat. We had a Mennonite congregation that met here for several years, so they got proper quarters and have been hospitable to various Christian groups that, whose churches have burned or have been reconstructed and the like, and have often had the debaters from, or other groups from Central Catholic, when they've had tournaments, come over and use our facilities. And of course, have done lots with QED also, and with Carnegie Mellon. So we've always been open to that. And then my effort, let's talk about interfaith relations, because this really is part of that. My effort was, first of all, to do a lot with dialogue groups, small dialogue groups, Catholic and Protestant, and then the Milton Harris Interfaith Lecture, which is an annual lecture, brings a Jewish scholar to the Christian clergy community, Protestant and Catholic. About 400 ministers attend, and it is the largest occasion in which Catholics and Protestants and Jews share together intellectually.
Oh, just a tiny biographical sketch about Milton Harris.
Milton Harris was the was president of our brotherhood, was chair of the worship committee for a while, was chancellor of the Chautauqua Society and the national president of the brotherhood. So when he died in 74, I believe, his widow established this this lectureship, and she just died earlier this year, and she continued to be interested in this. And then, of course, there was lots of speaking in the general community, and lots of communal meetings, and lots of work with the predecessor of Christian Associates, which was a council of churches, and Jews were included in that. Christian Associates, by its very title, excludes Jews. So there were some leadership organizations that were established over the years in which the various bishops and one or two of us as rabbis meet representing the Jewish community. And we have often been hosts also to efforts, for example, in the early 80s, I think, when the steel mill started closing, there was an effort of the religious community to do something to stimulate the industrialists to more employment in these areas, particularly the Mon Valley. And we hosted those meetings for several years and tried in this way to move things forward. The problem, of course, with clergy, and to a lesser extent with rabbis, is that there's always an effort to be very inclusive, which has its positive and its negative, and to carefully look at every minority opinion. And what that means is that you end up getting very little done. And if you want to move, you really have to, and I've done that several times, you know, invite three or four people and say, let's do this. And when they indicate, well, supposing we invite, and then I say, no, we really got to do this now. And four of us can do this. A dozen can never do this. And we also had Thanksgiving services, first only for the Jewish community, and it traveled around to various synagogues, and then for the area general community, and it travels around to synagogues and churches. And also in those early years, I guess you could count this as ecumenical, three of us, Rabbi Halpern, Rabbi Pukko, and I, decided to establish a rabbinic fellowship, which would bring all the rabbis of the area together. And that continues. And it's carefully balanced with veto power for everybody. But that means that no controversial issues will be touched. But on the other hand, it has meant that we are together, we talk to each other, we have a forum for dealing with problems, even if we never vote on an issue. Everybody has accepted the changes in the rabbinate, like women rabbis.
What is the relationship that you have, or in general, generically actually, the way I mean, that the Reform movement has with, like Rabbi Buka, who was very orthodox?
The relationship has always been good. We've always talked to each other. And of course, the Reform movement is by far the strongest in the city. And the conservative is next, and the Orthodox is third. So that has probably helped matters. But we have never gotten the kind of enmity that exists in so many other cities, where people don't talk to each other, give aggressive sermons, critical sermons about each other. And at the same time, also established this column in the paper, sermon column, which I've edited since